Case number 15-1436 et al. Prime Healthcare Sentinella, LLC, doing business at Sentinella Hospital Medical Center, petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Ms. Kernaghan for the petitioner, Ms. Ginn for the respondent.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Jason Kernaghan of Shepard, Mullen, Richter, and Hampton, on behalf of the petitioner and cross-respondent, Prime Healthcare Sentinella, LLC. As a young prosecutor in the United States Navy, one of the first lessons I learned was not to overreach in a case. When you're asserting charges against an accused and you overreach, it can lead you down the path of failure from the outset of a case. And here what we have is overreaching by the union in its information requests, by the administrative law judge in the determination that impasse was not reached and that the refusal to respond to the July 23rd request was unjustified, and then overreaching by the board by affirming the administrative law judge's decisions.
So on the theme of overreaching, I guess my concern is that we not overreach, and that leads into the standard of review question, similar to the last case, frankly. We have a deferential standard of review to the board here, and then the key, if I'm analyzing this correctly, and push back on me if I'm not, the key is that they think the information requests met the low bar of relevance, and from there everything else follows on impasse, and we're reviewing all of that deferentially. So how do you get around that?
Well, I would rely on the Litton case cited in our brief that this is such a gross departure from the established precedent and the facts of the case that you need to take a look closer than deferential. I mean, if you look at the July 23rd request, it's made under the guise of they needed information regarding Carrot facilities for proper evaluation of the exclusive provider organization plan, the EPO plan, as I'll call it. But let's look at the facts here. Bargaining started in December 2009. The EPO plan was first introduced in February 2010 at the bargaining table. This request was not made until July 23rd, 2010, after 5 months of bargaining.
But that goes, I guess, to motive, and, you know, there's a reasonable case there that you can make, but that's not what we're really reviewing, their true motive. We're reviewing whether it met a low bar of relevance, and the dissenting member on the board thought that it was outside, it didn't get the presumptively relevant treatment, but still thought it met the bar of relevance, member Ms. Gamara. I take your point on their real motive. I get that, but I don't think we can really get into that too much.
Well, the standard as set forth in Keauhou Beach Hotel is it necessary and relevant? And because they're seeking information that's outside of this bargaining unit. We're looking at 18 hospitals here. Prime Sentinella is located in Inglewood, California, off the 405 right by LAX. Hospitals in Northern California, San Diego, Texas, Pennsylvania, Nevada have no relevance to the bargain at this facility because from a practical matter, people are not gonna drive from Los Angeles to Hershey, Pennsylvania to see their primary care physician.
Was the request relevant as to the hospitals that were in the area?
It was overbroad in scope in that regard.
My question is, to the extent it sought, I get that it sought more than that, there's the big circle, I'm asking you a smaller circle inside that sought this information as to the hospitals that were reasonably likely to be used by the employees. Was it relevant as to that? Was that subset relevant?
No, because some of the information they requested were PEPA reports. PEPA reports deals with...
No, but I think that was turned down by the board, or ALJ, one of those two. So let's put that aside.
Okay, let's put that aside.
The septicemia rates at the hospitals they were likely to use, was that relevant?
That's information that can be obtained to the Joint Commission and also infringes...
There's no answer to not turning it over.
It was overbroad in time and scope. The Sentinella facility was not acquired by the employer until 2007. Many of the other facilities were only recently acquired.
Okay, so
and seeking information
for
going back
5 years, for the hospitals and medical facilities that these folks were reasonably likely to use, septicemia rates. That's encompassed within this request. Was that relevant?
We'll never know because on August 24th...
I'm just asking your opinion as counsel for the company. Does that meet the legal standard for relevance?
I believe not, no.
Because
I think it was for an improper motive. It was for a purpose of gamesmanship.
If it was for an angelic motive, would it be relevant?
If it was for an angelic motive, the specific question of septicemia rates with respect to this plan when it was not requested with respect to any other plans, no, I do not believe so.
Because
what we're talking about here is a requirement that you have a primary care physician who is the gatekeeper. That was the holdup here. And septicemia rates with respect to blood infections or the pressure ulcers that might require...
They were going to be required to use these hospitals for medical care, correct?
No.
They needed hospitalization?
No, because you could go to the Anthem PPO plan.
If they
so there was no requirement.
The PPO plan, if they were doing the EPO plan, which was part of what you were offering, I really questioned, if you're in the EPO plan, this is where you'd go, correct?
Potentially, yes.
Potentially. Or they might go to one of those further away hospitals.
Well, when... Or an out-of-network facility.
Right, which costs a lot of money, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at here is my understanding of the law, you tell me if I've got it wrong, is that if there were at least material portions of the request that were relevant, the fact that there may be some things that the employer thinks were too broad in time or too broad in coverage, does not mean you just get to refuse to answer anything, that it's on the employer, tell me if I got this wrong, that it's on the employer to say, look, almost like discovery, here's the things that you've legitimately asked for, in our view, here's what you get. Now, we're not going to go back 10 years, we think that's too long, but give a reasoned explanation. We're not going to all the hospitals, but we'll go to the ones that it's foreseeable you all have to use, because that seems reasonable to us. But the employer here didn't do that. So do I have the law backwards?
I think it's not the law, it's the factual inquiry, because as set forth in the August 24, 2010 letter from the hospital, they offered to meet and confer face-to-face with the union, and they also offered to enter into a confidentiality agreement with respect to certain document production.
Well, that's a different issue, confidentiality. The ALJ found that there was no confidentiality issues. The union agreed to take out all personal identifying information. So that's a separate question than the question Judge Millett is asking. So assume for the moment that that's not part of the issue. What's the answer to her question?
The hospital offered a face-to-face meet and confer to resolve these issues. It's set forth in writing. It's at the Volume 2 of the Joint Appendix, 11:19-24, I believe. And in there, expressly states, let's sit down and talk about these issues. And on September 15, 2010, the union unequivocally rejected that request. So to hold the hospital
to... Sorry, so is there any case law that says that's a sufficient response to a document request that includes at least a material percentage of relevant inquiries?
Well, I think it would run afoul of the case law, such as Local 13 of the Detroit Press, that the union is under an obligation to bargain in good faith. And this is not a good faith negotiation with respect to this production if they're refusing to meet face-to-face.
So it sounds like mainly what you're relying on here is the bad faith argument. If you didn't have, I get that you say you do. If you didn't have that maybe this wouldn't work, but it sounds to me like you're saying the reason the approach taken by the employer was sufficient in this case is because you had a sort of bad faith concerns here and you wanted to meet to address it that way. Am I understanding your argument right? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No. They might be better than my own. Along those lines, I think, yes, there had to be a discussion between the parties to determine, you know, what hospitals are in the kind of the zone or sphere of actual usage, and then you can move on as to what documentation with respect to those facilities would be appropriate. However, based on the September 15th rejection of the offer for a face-to-face meeting, this isn't let's exchange more letters, this is outside of the bargaining table, let's have the parties get together in a meeting and discuss.
What's the page? Just tell me again the JA page of the request for the meeting.
It's volume 2, JA 1128. It's an August 24, 2010 letter to Daniel Bush, who was the lead negotiator from the union.
Volume 2?
I'm sorry, volume 3, Your Honor. I apologize. Volume 3, 1128.
Why would they want to do that outside the bargaining? I'm just curious. Why would they say, let's do that instead of just, because I thought for the union's response was look, we're in negotiations. Let's do this through the negotiating process. But is there, you know, you're representing the employer. Is there a reason?
I misspoke. Not necessarily outside the bargaining context, but, you know, a separate bargaining session with respect to this discrete issue, not the proposals.
Oh, okay. So a session just on the document. Request.
Correct. And I apologize for misspeaking in that regard. And Your Honor, if you look at 1128, it states in the third full paragraph, second sentence, quote, as such, I would like to schedule a face-to-face meeting with you to discuss the SEIU's positions and that of Sentinella. And it's specifically referencing the disagreements over documents in connection with the proposed EPO plan.
They don't say anything other than it's too broad. They were given a very extensive letter from the union explaining the relevance of every element of the request dated August 17th.
Well, the August 17th request in and of itself narrowed the scope of the request in that it referenced five Los Angeles hospitals, only mentioning one by name.
That's not answering my question. I'm saying the union, and this is the letter that the board and the ALJ relied on, very specific about why its requests are relevant. The response doesn't say why they're not relevant.
And that was the purpose of the face-to-face meeting, so they wouldn't have back and forth in these letters. It was, let's sit down and try to hammer out a solution.
But then the union responded in a perfectly reasonable way, saying, look, we don't want to have this separate meeting. Let's do it as part of the negotiations. We'll make it the first order of business, but we believe it's all relevant. We've explained to you why it's that. And so was it the first order of business at the next meeting, and why wasn't it provided then?
Well, the next bargaining session, rather than discuss the issue with respect to document production, the union provided an EPL proposal. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they were able to provide an EPL proposal at the next scheduled bargaining session after this correspondence exchange evidences that the information really wasn't necessary and relevant to make
the proposal. No, I don't think at all. I think it evidences that the union was engaged in good faith negotiations, but they're still got to know about this EPL plan. They got to know before they can recommend it.
And there was full and fair opportunity to discuss it at the September 30th bargaining session. There's no evidence in the record that it was. With that, I have reserved some time for rebuttal, so if there's any more questions,
I'll see. All right, well, hear from the NLRB.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Amy Ginn for the NLRB. I will just pick up where we left off with this idea that the union was not willing to bargain over the information request. Indeed, the union responded to the request for a face-to-face meeting between only the lead negotiators with the statement that they would be willing to bargain about the information request and health insurance at the next session and make it the first order of business. So there's just no evidence here that the union was not willing to negotiate over this information request. And the hospital at no time provided or offered to provide any information responsive to the request as to any hospitals or as to any of the requested categories of information. In terms of the statement that the union somehow narrowed its information request in its August 17th letter, and this is at JA 1120, also in Volume 3, so just prior to the letters we were just looking at. In that letter, the union did not narrow its request to only five hospitals. The union made a statement on page 1120 that five of the six hospitals in the United States with the highest septicemia rates are prime hospitals in the Los Angeles area, and then named one particular hospital. By making that statement as background information as to its concern about the, quote, astonishing septicemia rates of the hospitals, the union was certainly not narrowing its request for the information to only those hospitals.
Can I ask you a question? So there's the sort of very generous discovery standard of relevance that's used for whether or not an information request was relevant and properly made. And then IMPAS also asks whether whether the failure to turn over information was relevant, sort of in a causal sense, to the IMPAS. Is that, you couldn't have some little side thing here and then say maybe that would have foreclosed finding an IMPAS if there was just some side little information dispute. There has to be some relevance to the outstanding information request before it would lead to an impasse. But I'm trying to understand how that relevance inquiry compares to the relevance inquiry for the information request in the first place. Am I at all clear on what I'm asking?
Let me try. So the cases that say that a failure to provide relevant information precludes a finding of genuine impasse, those cases talk about the fact that the failure to provide relevant information has to be as to a core issue in the bargaining. Mm-hmm. I mean, so in this case, we know that healthcare, the EPO plan, is a big issue in the bargaining. We know that's what the information request goes to. That's similar to other cases that we cite in our brief, like the DuPont case, the U.S. testing case, where the failure to provide information was as to a key issue that the parties were bargaining over.
No, but is it any?
There are other situations that, and I don't believe this is in our brief, but it is in the board's order. There's a case called Sierra Bullets. In that case, there were key issues that the parties were having trouble reaching agreement on. There were several. One was management rights. I think there may have been a subcontracting issue. There was also separately a bargaining violation for failure to provide information about overtime. Now, the board in that case said, okay, failure to provide information about overtime, it was relevant to bargaining, so it's still a separate independent violation of the Act, but it didn't preclude a finding of impasse in that case because it didn't go to the core issues that the parties were having trouble resolving. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
That was very helpful, but I'm still wondering when you say when it's relevant to a core issue, I get there has to be a nexus between the information request and a core issue.
Okay.
But could it be something that sort of under discovery standard of relevance is, for example, the request for, they asked for like essentially a nine or 10 year period of information mm-hmm. here, and say they had provided 5 years of information on Medicare billings and discharges, and then provided everything else the union had asked for. And so we're missing 4 years from the Medicare billing and
right.
discharges,
okay.
which would meet relevant standard under maybe if the bird, you know, I'm not saying it would be presumed relevant, but it could meet relevant standard generically on whether it's a legitimate information request.
Right.
But would that be enough? Would that make it irrelevant?
Right. I understand what you're saying. I don't specifically know the answer to that. I can't think of a case that deals with that. So, for example, most of the information is provided. I mean, the idea is that the union has to be able to carry out its bargaining duties. So I think there would be an argument there if the union has most of the information or substantially all of the information, are they still really precluded from carrying out their bargaining duties to the extent that they couldn't reach an agreement and impasse would be precluded? I don't specifically know the answer. I mean, I think there could be some argument there that it's not increasing the friction between the parties and the type of thing that creates a problem when you don't provide relevant information that the union needs. That segues a little bit into another point that the hospital made in their briefing, which was that they say that there's no evidence that providing this information would have caused the union to agree to the hospital's terms. And as we discussed in our brief, that's simply not the standard. There doesn't have to be evidence that the union would accede to a certain demand because it's now been provided with the information. The idea is the information is important for the union to decide what stance it wants to take in bargaining, or to decide, I mean, in this case, to decide with respect to the EPO plan, they need to know the quality of care because they're being asked to pay substantially more than what they were paying for their prior plan. And they've agreed at this point that there will be an EPO plan. They understand the hospital's position on that, but the terms are still to be worked out in terms of access to the outside network, how much that will cost employees, how much the overall plan will cost employees. And so the union is trying to determine how much we're willing to pay for what we're going to get, and what they don't know is what are we going to get.
On, because this request went for a long, like I think it was either 9 or 10 years of time. Assume it were asking for information about wage patterns. So it's something that normally would be presumptively relevant.
Right.
Does the scope of the time scope of the inquiry factor into presumptive relevance, or do we just look at the substantive content of what they're asking for?
I can't think of any cases that limit the relevance of information based on the time scope. I think it would depend. It depends on looking at, is there probable or potential relevance to the union's position in bargaining and to carrying out their duties in bargaining. And so, I mean, the board would have to consider an argument that was made to it, which I don't believe this, an argument was certainly made here that the information request was overly broad. With respect to the time scope here and the argument that Prime didn't own these hospitals during some of that period, the request itself is written very specifically directed at Prime. So if Prime didn't own the hospital in 2001, it wouldn't have any of this information from 2001. And nothing in the information request is asking them to go get it from their predecessor. It's just saying exchanges between Prime and whether it's a regulator or within the Prime facilities that was exchanged. So there's no request for information that's outside the time that Prime owned the facilities, if they didn't own them in 2001, which is when the request started.
Can I ask you a question about this motion for abeyance?
Sure.
It looks like this 2014 agreement require, if it were to be enforced mm-hmm. by the board, and I'm not asking you to speculate on that, requires the dismissal of all unfair labor practice charges. Would that include this one, the ones at issue in this case?
Your Honor, I believe the parties have stated that their understanding was it would. However, at this point, the charging party union in this case cannot simply dismiss a charge now that we have a final order of the board. So at the time that the parties were negotiating that in November 2014, there was no final order of the board in this case. The board order came in November 2015. Now that there's a final order of the board, and there are some policies and procedure memos that I could point you to on this subject, but the board will not allow a charging party to simply dismiss a case once there's a board order finding violation of the act. Any settlement, for example, has to be approved by the board once there's a final board order.
Is that part of this proceeding then that would go on before the board right now? As part of it, if they were to approve it, they would have to, in the process of approving it, approve the dismissal?
So the, if, right. I'm sorry.
So whether they should enforce the 2014 agreement is an issue before the board right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that 2014 agreement, as written, says dismiss unfair labor practice charges, which the party's intent was to include this case. So does that mean that part of the board's proceeding there, if it were to decide that it should enforce, and I think agree with the ALJ, if I'm correct in that case, that it should be enforced, would necessarily in that process determine that these charges should be dismissed. It's the board. I mean, it's the board's decision to make, and presumably it would make it as part of enforcing the agreement.
So the ALJ's decision that's currently pending before the board states that the hospital is required to execute the agreement that was reached in November 2014. The board in that case will not be looking at the substantive terms of that agreement. So the board won't be looking at the substantive terms to say anything about dismissing those charges. I mean, why
wouldn't the general counsel point this out? You've got an agreement here and say, look, there's a wrinkle now, because it seems like you can't enforce something that doesn't let them get their side, their part of the benefit of the bargain. That would seem quite unusual to me.
I mean, again, I'm stating my understanding that the parties are including the charges in this case in that document. It doesn't give the case numbers. It doesn't state that. That's my understanding. I don't even know if that's for certain, the contemplation. I mean, not being a party to that document or anything to that effect. I don't know that it's been discussed in any of the papers in that other case either.
And it's not incumbent on the general counsel here to flag this issue and address it?
Well, again, the general counsel isn't looking at the substance of requiring the parties to enter into any kind of substantive agreement. I mean, the issue in that case was whether, my understanding, because again, I'm not involved with that case, was whether the parties indeed had reached an agreement that then the hospital failed to execute.
So I guess it would be incumbent on the company to raise this issue before the board and let them know it needs to get resolved too.
It would certainly be incumbent upon the company to raise that, or the hospital to raise that issue to the board. Just more broadly, there, in this case that's before the court right now, there is no need for abeyance in this case. There is a continuing obligation in the board's order to cease and desist from the activities that were found to be in violation of the act. There's a rescission of the unilateral changes that were made. And to the extent that the hospital is arguing that in November 2014, they reached a collectively bargained agreement with the union on a health care plan, that, and they want to argue that that is in compliance with the order in this case, that's something they will have the opportunity to do in the future. If they feel that the board gets it wrong in the future in assessing that, they can bring it back again at that point. But they do have obligations also in this order that go beyond simply what's stated in the November 2014
term sheet. Right, but that would, in theory, maybe go away if the November 2014 settlement were to go forward.
Portions of the board's order they may have complied with already if they have done what is stated in the November 2014 term sheet. I don't know if that's happened, but for example, if they already partially made whole the unit employees for these additional premiums that they had to pay, which is something that's contemplated in that term sheet, if they've already done so, that's partial compliance with the board's order, and they can show that at the time that they go into compliance proceedings.
How long do these compliance proceedings take to be initiated? How long could they be hanging out there under two different orders? Do they get started right away?
Compliance proceedings can certainly start right away. I mean, there are times compliance proceedings begin even before court enforcement of an order, but that's up to the respondent to agree to do so. I mean, Regents will at any time consider, arguments about compliance or evidence in particular of compliance.
Well, does a company have an ability to say, shoot, suddenly we're here betwixt and between, we need to have a compliance proceeding now, or is it entirely in the control of the regional director for timing?
The regional director is responsible for, the showing the back pay that's owed, those types of things, or in this case, I guess it would be back health care reimbursement that's owed. I mean, so that is incumbent upon the region to produce those documents, and the hospital would have to wait for that to happen.
Okay, your red light's on. Thank you very much. We'll hear from, do we have any time for the other side? All right, we'll give you 2 minutes, too.
And, Your Honor, just to touch on your statements with respect to the abeyance.
Did you raise the issue of the abeyance before the board? Did you raise the issue of inconsistency before the board? at any time?
I'm not the one to answer that question because Shepherd Mullen is not the firm handling that other matter. I know the issue.
The board says you didn't, so in their response to the brief, so I assume you looked into that and you found that you did not raise the issue before the board.
My understanding is that it has not, as I stand here today, it has not yet been raised before
the board. That means we don't have jurisdiction. Any issue not raised before the board, we're statutorily barred from considering.
But the consideration with respect to holding an abeyance is not yet right because they have not been before the board.
But you had an opportunity to settle the case if you wanted to. You could have complied with the agreement and not challenged it. You challenged it. So cases go on. That's what happens when people don't ultimately resolve the matter. If you settle the case today, you go back, you go outside there, you agree to do everything that they ask, maybe you reach a settlement before we issue an opinion. But otherwise, once we've issued an opinion, that's the end of it. An opinion doesn't become moot after it's issued. So that's your chance. You've had a chance since you discovered this problem, and maybe you have a few more hours after today, or maybe it takes us a little bit longer. But there's no reason for us to stop the case now when the issue, you haven't even raised the issue before the board.
Well, what I'd say in that regard is that since that issue will still proceed before the board, mm-hmm. there is a real risk for inconsistent rulings. And my concern is that getting a compliance hearing will not be as expeditious as represented, especially in light of the general counsel memo mm-hmm. that came out on Tuesday, citing the numerous budgetary shortfalls, staffing issues, and otherwise hindrances on the processing of cases. I think that should inconsistent rulings be issued, that a compliance proceeding is not going to be something that is months or years in the making. It could be multiple years in the making.
Well, what is your objection to the agreement, to the settlement agreement? Why was it appealed?
I'm sorry?
Why was there an appeal?
I do not.
You don't know? Okay.
I want to disclose attorney-client communications in that regard.
Okay. I'm certainly not asking for that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You want to respond at all? You have 43 seconds. You want to respond at all to the arguments made by the opposing counsel?
The only argument I'd raise is that here, again, we're not relying on a presumption of relevance. We're relying, because it's seeking operations outside of the bargaining unit, so it's a heightened standard, and it's the union who's under the burden to establish that relevance. And it's also
what about Judge Millett's point, which was you didn't just refuse to provide information about outside hospitals. You refused to provide any information at all. When I say you, by the way, not Shepherd Mullen, not you personally, your client.
Understood, Your Honor. Well, I guess I would invite the court's attention to Columbus Products Company, which states that it's on the union to show that the failure to provide this information impeded it from discharging its statutory obligations.
Well, they've made that argument, there, and that ALJ upheld it. That is, for precisely the point that the opposing counsel made, which the question here of whether there was sufficient quality for the union to be willing to have its members pay depended on how good the hospitals were. And if they couldn't find out whether the hospitals were good or not, they couldn't find out whether they wanted to force their employees into their members into those hospitals, but more importantly, whether the amount that would be paid would be appropriate. That seems like and you yourself say in your brief say that the health care is the critical issue in this in the bargaining.
Correct, health care, and what we're referring to is a health plan, an EPO plan, that was already in place at Garden Grove Hospital, at Encino Hospital, for which the union was already representing members. It had been in place for 7 months at the time that the request for information had
As they point out, it's not the same members, different members. The members here, and they have an obligation to represent these members.
It's the same plan, Your Honor. So
it's the same plan, but they have an obligation to the members for these other hospitals to decide what they should do.
And I don't disagree that the argument's been made. My position and Prime's position is that there hasn't been any nexus established between the argument and the actual evidence of how it was impeded. And if you look at the September 30th bargaining notes from the union, it clearly establishes that they're not going to be able to go forward based upon the diametrical opposite positions of the hospital and the union, and there is no reference to this information that's missing. It's just philosophical differences regarding the PCP, the primary care position, primary care physician gatekeeper position and the fact that employees will be required to contribute if they want family health care.
Can I ask one fact question? When the company announced to the employees in September 2010 it was going to be instituting this new plan, and there was a process for, I think, waiving in or applying to have a physician waived in?
Correct. There's a physician nominating process. Right. Okay. It's something we made the union aware of on August 23rd and then sent the memo on September
1st. I actually have a fact question. Does the record show whether any employees filled out those forms?
I don't believe so.
No, it didn't.
It's not part of the work.
Okay, we'll take the matter under submission and thank both sides.
Thank you very much.